Good afternoon, good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of the Daily Friend Show. I'm your host, Nicholas Lorimer, and I'm joined today by Mr. Marius Root. Marius, how are you? I believe you're in Cape Town. You fled the East Rand. Why is that so?
How's it, guys? My brother lives down here, so I just came to have a look and considering maybe moving abroad to Cape Town. So I just come to have a look. So yeah, I've just been here for a couple of days and back in Joburg on Sunday.
And Sholin, you are also joining us from Cape Town. Sholin, how are you?
I'm doing good, Nick. And I'm just happy that Marius decided to come and visit a first world country down in the Cape. I hope he enjoys his stay. Yeah.
All right, let's get into the news. So the most important thing, I think, today and tomorrow is the release of the matric results across the country. Tomorrow we're getting the majority of schools in South Africa when the government exam system releases its results. But the Independent Education Board, or the Independent Examinations Board, rather, the IEB, released its results today. And unsurprisingly, it did very well, as it almost always does. If one was asking the question, how do I pass matric, it seems as though the answer is to go to an IEB school. The matric pass rate for IEB schools was 98.42%, which is, of course, very good. And of those people who passed, just under 90% achieved a bachelor's pass, which is the sort of highest level of pass that's recorded. And this is despite the fact that the grade 10s and 11s, whose results this were, they went through COVID at the absolute worst time. Of course, they would have been going into grade 10 just as the pandemic hit. And your curriculum for matric is, it begins in grade 10 and it finishes, obviously, when you matriculate. So this meant that they had to adapt very quickly to the conditions. I'm sure there was a lot of online learning. And despite all of this, the results are actually very slightly up from last year, when they were just under the 98% last time, 98.4% last time. So I guess the question is, and Maurice, let me start with you. Why is it that the IEB schools were able to weather the storm of COVID and achieve such a great result?
Yeah, well, I think it's also a big question of resources. Most schools that write IEB exams, probably the vast majority are, probably all of them, are going to be very well-resourced schools. People who go there are going to probably come from mainly middle-class families. They're going to have access to the internet. You know, probably online learning wasn't such a big problem for a lot of people. Of course, you'll lose a lot of the kinds of things that you get from face-to-face learning. But I'm sure a lot of people who go to IB, or most people who went to IB schools, have access to internet and laptops and all that kind of thing. So this disruption was probably a bit, not as hectic as it was for people in, say, more poorly resourced schools and so on, where I think that was a real blow to learning in the last 2 years. You know, if somebody goes to a school in Lusigisi where, nobody's parents are employed, the school probably doesn't have electricity or whatever, people who live in those kind of areas aren't going to have internet or have laptops and so on, obviously through no fault of their own. I mean, there won't be, the opportunities for employment and so on in a place like Lusigisi. So I think a lot of it does come down to simply a question of resources, and IEB schools are probably going to be also pretty well staffed and so on. So I don't know if the IEB is, we had to look at it like it's a better kind of run organization than when it comes to exams and say the GDE, but I think it's definitely a question of resources and so on. But I did some research a couple of years ago and I looked at matric results broken down. And this was for government schools, broken down by former Model T schools and schools that were under the old Department of Education and Training, which was obviously black schools, and also schools that were reserved for colored and Indian people in the old days. And if you broke those results down, the matric results for former Model T schools were obviously not as, while they weren't as impressive as these IB results, they were still pretty good. Most Model T schools get you know, pass rates of 80 to 90%. Some get 100%. They also get pretty good bachelor's pass rates. And also looked, I broke this down by race. And while black kids most of the time didn't have pass rates or bachelor pass rates as high as white pupils and so on, they were still much higher than the kind of results they were getting in former blacks-only schools. So, and I think that also comes down to a question of resources. Even, say, somebody who maybe comes from a poorer background, but they're attending a Model C school, they're going to have better support in the school. They might say there might be more opportunity for bursaries. There might be some kind of program where they can have access to a laptop that they can buy from the school or whatever the case is. So I think a lot of this simply comes down to resources and so on. And I think we'll see, you know, while South Africa is in its current economic state, we're going to see these kind of educational outcomes from, you know, from many government schools and so on. So yeah, it's at the end of that, it's often a question of, you know, resources, economic resources. And while we're in the current situations of this country with the, you know, load shedding and all that kind of thing, and probably economic growth about 1% this year, unfortunately, that's not really going to change.
Yeah, it looks like a lot of the schools that did really well in the, a lot of the IB schools or the Curro schools, which can cost, I think this year, something around 82,000 rand a year for someone between grade 10 and matric, which is quite expensive, but not as much as I think some of those other, you know, the like the old fashioned the sort of boys boarding schools or girls boarding schools, that kind of thing. Sholem, what do you make of this? You know, what lessons can the rest of the education system, do you think, learn from our IB system? I mean, I think resource is definitely part of it. And obviously not every school in the country can be as well resourced as some of the IB schools. But it's not just about resources. It's also about, I think, how you spend that money. What are your thoughts? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no, I absolutely agree with that, Nick. I mean, the results are obviously no surprise. Maybe it is a surprise because of COVID and all of those things. But I think we've consistently seen this type of performance for IB schools, private schools. And I think it also comes down to some of the things Marius mentioned, you know, that private schools tend to be, you know, the better, have better facilities, staff. I think there's an accountability mechanism that is, there's a culture of accountability in private schools that I think is lacking, at least from my experience, as going into a public school, where parents tend to be way more engaged, holding teachers accountable for the performance, the senior staff. I think that is crucial, and I think it's overlooked at times. With this, Nick, the results just came out today. Was it yesterday? And I've already seen.
No, I think it's today.
Was today, and I've already seen comments of people like saying, you know what, this just goes to speak to the inequality that exists in South Africa's education system and so forth. And while many of these critics are so focused on the success of the private schools, nobody is actually speaking already in expectation about the failures of the national government and how they are dealing, and provincial government as well, governments. Dealing with how public schools are actually run. I also think that, yeah, resources. South Africa's government does spend a lot of money on our public schools. So I don't necessarily think if the amount of money is the problem, but I think the way it is managed through all of those bureaucratic channels, what it is spent on, I think that is where we are actually lacking in that decision-making, Nick.
Yeah, you know, so I went to an IB school, and I always kind of got the impression that after a certain point, after a certain level, the fees are really actually kind of just paying for some of the extras, you know, the gigantic sports fields, the astroturfs, the swimming pools, the what. And I think that you know, when it comes to the actual education, you don't actually need to be one of the top schools in the country to get, as Marius pointed out, with some of those Model C schools, some really good results. It's also worth remembering that in the IB system, there is choice. Parents at this level can choose where to send their kids, and there's lots of options. There's the Curro schools, there's like the Crawford stuff, there's the old boarding houses like Studien, St. John's, St. Michael House, Hilton, those places if you're very wealthy. And that really does create this competitive market where every single school is offering a certain culture, a certain way of doing things. And that means that ultimately the student benefits. And I think the question is that the IRR has always posed is, why can't we do that for South Africa's poor? And that's exactly what our school vouchers idea is about. It's about the government saying, okay, here's a voucher. You can send your kid to whichever school you want, basically, that this voucher can pay for. And you have the decision as a parent where to take your kid in much more than you currently do. And I think that could really open up so many opportunities for South Africa's parents to make sure that their kids got the education they deserved, and also open up a big new space in private education, which, as countries like India have shown, is not a preserve of the rich. You can make low-cost, affordable, quality private education. Maurice, do you have any final thoughts?
Yeah, just 2 points. Also, just want to also emphasize that this, obviously, talking about these various schools is a bit of generalization. You obviously, there are schools in, you know, old townships, for a better term, where also get excellent results. You get, you know, 100% pass rates, sometimes up to close to 100% university entrance rates. And often, you know, you'll sometimes these schools will be featured in the newspaper or whatever. And often comes down to a principal who's really dedicated, make sure teachers are there on time, make sure they work hard, making sure they're there every day. There's discipline for the kids. You know, kids have to be there at 8 or 7:30, whatever the case is. Don't allow things like, you know, the uniform strict. Don't allow kids to get away with things like smoking. So I think, you know, there's lots of different moving parts of these kinds of things. And just what also what Sholin said, where instead of looking what, when looking at schools that have done well, people argue and say, well, you know, we must bring, they're basically saying we must bring schools that are doing well down to the level of poorer schools, where, and that's a big problem in South Africa. I think people, they want to, it's a kind of a tall poppy syndrome. And I mean, it's a bit of a trite thing to say, but you can't strengthen the weak by weakening the strong. And I think what the emphasis should be is on bringing up standards rather than trying to lower standards. And we should, you know, any kid in whatever part of South Africa should be able to go to, obviously not everybody's going to be able to go to St. John's or Michaelhouse, but every kid in South Africa should be able to have the option to go to a school where their teachers, there's a dedicated principal, they can play sports if they want to. And I think, you know, just to be able to get a good level of education that, you know, gives you a decent start in life. And unfortunately, I think there are too many kids in South Africa who don't even have that option. You know, they don't even get that, the option to have a decent start at the school level. And I think that has lots of consequences for those individuals and for South Africa as a whole.
Oh, definitely. The quality of South Africa's education, I think, has been one of the biggest, one of the worst things that the current ANC government has done, is that it has hollowed out or at least failed to improve the education for so many millions of South Africans who have gone through the schooling system having learned very little. And that's going to create social problems, which we will be dealing with for many, many years after the ANC government is gone. But speaking of social problems and government policy that totally backfired, let's talk a little bit about China and its population. So some news came out, I believe it was either today or yesterday, that for the first time since 1961, China's population has fallen. It fell. It's currently at 1.4118 billion. And it fell by 850,000 people from 2021.
So can't China's, you read up the whole number without saying the billion, Nick?
Do
a Jacob Zuma, you know?
Yeah, 169. Listen properly. So China's birth rate, it's been going down for a long time. In 1979, they introduced this thing called the one-child policy, which is, I think, one of the most horrific long-term policies has ever been introduced in sort of world history. It resulted in all sorts of horrific abuses of the Chinese population, up to including, you know, I mean, apart from the fact that you were fined for having more than one child without a license, there have been cases of people who were forced to get abortions. There were cases of people killing their child because they weren't the gender that they wanted. It was an absolute nightmare. And it seems as though it has caused significant damage to the demographics of China, which is now sitting with a population that is getting pretty old pretty quickly. There have been attempts, I think, since the mid-2010s, I think somewhere around 2014, when they repealed the one-child policy, to actually boost the birth rate to make up for this problem, but it really doesn't seem to have worked. China's birth rate is 6.7 per 1,000 people, which is much lower than even other countries that have declining birth rates, such as the United States with 11 births per 1,000 people, and the United Kingdom with 10 births per 1,000 people. And India, which is very likely, I think this year, to overtake China as the most populous country in the world, has a birth rate of 16 per 1,000 people. So China is, I think, about to suffer a very serious demographic problem where, as the trite saying that people have been throwing around goes, they may run the risk of growing old before they grow truly wealthy. Sholin, I think, you know, there's been a lot of talk, particularly in the last 10 years, about the rise of China and the Chinese century and how China is set to take over world leadership in terms of economics. This may cause some problems. What do you think?
I definitely think it will cause some problems, Nick. I mean, having a large population is probably one of China's selling point, mainly because, you know, I'm no special economist or anything, but it's easy to understand that having a large population means that there are potentially more people who can be productive and actually work and actually contribute to the economy, more people to buy and sell and more people to produce. I mean, this definitely hurts China as a manufacturing hub, because that's what they basically tell all of these international corporations and companies, like, you can come over here, we will build your products, we will make them, we will do it for cheaper, and we have more labor. And I mean, that's such a good selling point to have. And now that is actually going against them because of the policies, like the one-child policy thing. And I mean, it's just a clear illustration of government overreach. You know, government should have no place at all to tell any individual how many kids they should be having and how many kids they shouldn't, be mandating things like that. I think that is complete overreach. And just with, like, broadly speaking, Nick, like, internationally, I think China finds itself in a difficult situation. I mean, finally, we are starting to see the United States, the European Union, Japan, Australia, all of these sort of adversaries of China starting to finally take a much more stronger stance, whether it's tough enough or not, against China. That's occurring. We're seeing probably who I think is China's best geopolitical asset, Russia, is currently failing in its war and is struggling against a country like Ukraine. I mean, it's harming the Chinese image if that's the country they wanted as their partner against the West. We're also seeing companies like Apple who are now finally deciding, you know what, we've seen things with how China handled the COVID lockdown, some of the policies, and now these companies are starting to bet on India instead, going to somebody who's also starting to be an opponent to China, especially wanting people to come and wanting to be a manufacturing hub. I think a combination of all of these things makes it a really difficult situation for China to be in, especially since everybody has this image that China is going to be smooth sailing towards this dominant power, you know, becoming the superpower, overtaking some of those in the West. I do think this it hinders their progress a bit, but I would caution against being like, okay, no, finally, this is the final coffin in China's final nail in China's coffin. I think that is definitely not the case. I think they still probably have a lot of fight in them. And I'm sure some people, some opponents of these are definitely thinking, okay, this is actually a good thing. But I wouldn't count against the Chinese, I think, Nick.
And Maurice, it's quite interesting because I think while China seems to be aging at a faster rate than a lot of other countries because of how low its birth rate is, this is not a unique problem to them, right? We've seen, especially in Europe, this problem where, and to some degree, even places like the United States, these old welfare systems, which promised pensions and generous benefits for people, they were always based on the assumption that there would be a growing population with new young people coming in who would be able to pay the taxes that would feed these systems. And now the population gets older and older. That means you have to spend more on healthcare. It means you have to spend more of your government budget on pensions. It means that people aren't necessarily as productive overall. And you really begin to realize that the great problem, perhaps, of the 21st century is not too many people, but too few. What do you make of all this, Maurice?
Well, the benefit that a lot of countries in Western Europe and the US and say Australia has is they are places where migrants want to go and they are fairly accepting of migrants. So while they have fairly low birth rates, a lot of that is supplemented by people coming from other places, come to live and work there. But people obviously don't really migrate to somewhere like China and the other places that have the same problem as China, Japan and South Korea. While they're obviously much more free and open societies than China, they're also fairly hostile to migrants. It's very hard to become a citizen of Japan if you aren't if you're a non-ethnic Japanese person. I think South Korea is fairly similar. So they have huge problems. I mean, South Korea has got the lowest birth rate in the world at the moment, and they're going to see huge population crashes by the middle of the century, Japan, South Korea. And even I think Russia's also got some similar problems. Its population is also busy shrinking and probably even worse now with people.
There are very few countries outside of Africa that aren't kind of facing the similar problem.
Exactly. And it's an issue. And while I still think it's going to be Asia century, it's probably going to be India century. And there's some speculation that India is probably already actually the most populous country in the world. Some people think that India actually already overtook China sometime last year. And another consequence of the one-child policy is, as you said, people were aborting fetuses and whatever because of the wrong gender. They were generally aborting girl babies because, you know, for better or worse, in a lot of cultures, it's seen as better to have a male as a baby, especially if you can only have one kid to carry on the family name and be the heir and all that kind of thing. So what's resulted is there are far more Chinese men than Chinese women. And, you know, and it's a fact of nature across the world. Single men with not much to do generally get up to nonsense. If they got a wife to go back to and a family to take care of, they generally become more responsible. They don't cause trouble, you know, and China that we don't, they obviously there's, I don't know the exact number, but I read, you know, I'm open to correction, but it could be something like 100 to 200 million surplus men. And, you know, that also causes social problems. You know, these people also feel lonely and all kinds of other issues. And this is something that's also actually a problem in parts of Africa where still people can have more than one wife. Then also same kind of thing happens. Men don't have a partner and whatever you. And what happens? They join gangs or militias and all that kind of thing. And, you know, maybe that could be a possibility in China. So, you know, lots of unintended consequences for China. And I think same thing. People are having a child in China is also pretty expensive. And I think social norms have maybe changed now where people got used to it only having one kid. And so people are happy now to, you know, women especially have probably more options also to for education and employment are happy to wait until they're, you know, early or mid 30s to because they know they're only going to have one child. So they don't really have to worry too much about problems of getting old. And, you know, if you have your first kid at 36 or 37, you're not going to have six more most probably. You know, so I think it's also a problem. And yeah, there have been some incentives. I know one city in China, I think it's Shenzhen, they suggested giving people a kind of a bonus each year in the first four years of a child's life. It was the couple's third child. But apparently there hasn't been much uptake for that because so few people are having more than two kids at the moment. So yeah, so China's got some big problems. You know, I think we can obviously can't see the future, but I think, yeah, I'm not sure how China's going to get out of this. And, you know, sometimes what happens when to distract from problems at home, then often countries look abroad to cause trouble. So I think the Taiwanese are probably looking across the Taiwan Strait, you know, with a bit of trepidation, especially what's going to happen in the next 5 years or the next decade or so.
Yeah, population growth, in at least my very not expert opinion, is a pretty important part of sort of sustainable long-term growth. And I think Japan is a really great example of how, you know, getting old very quickly is not great for your economy. Japan has really struggled to recover ever since its demographics really began to dip, I think, in the 90s.
And Japan didn't ever have a thing like a one-child policy. And they've also seen, nor did South Korea. Yeah. And there's some deeper underlying issues, I think, in those countries too, where we've seen these kind of things.
So I see Chris in the comments mentions that Hungary is a better model. I think I haven't read a huge amount about it, but I'm pretty sure that even Hungary's attempts to boost its birth rate have not actually been particularly successful. So this is a policy problem that I don't think anyone has actually figured out the answer to. And it's something that I think will consume quite a lot of intellectual energy in the decades ahead. Okay. We don't have a huge amount of time left, so let's just quickly move on to our next story. And I don't know how much we have to say about this, but I think it's probably worth mentioning that our president, Cyril Ramaphosa, has called for caution in how the electricity tariff hike is applied to South Africa. So as I'm sure everyone knows, the electricity tariff is being raised by 18.65%, which is a lot to try and rescue Eskom's terrible financial position. Ramaphosa has been quick to say that he is, quote, deeply concerned about the increase and that he feels the pain of customers who now have to pay more for electricity. A spokesperson for him said, quote, while the president appreciates fully that Eskom needs additional funding, he is equally sympathetic to the anger and frustration that is being felt by customers and households with regard to paying more for power that is intermittent. Therefore, it is vital that Eskom and municipalities consider a balance that needs to be maintained in the application of the tariff increase. Households already reeling under the high cost of living, electricity costs need to match the availability of megawatts and the electricity that people are receiving. Huh. So is he for the tariff or against it, Marius?
I think it's typical kind of doublespeak from the president. He says a lot of words to say absolutely nothing. And, you know, he's like tries to keep both sides happy and ends up keeping nobody happy. And it's typical from the president. I don't think anybody's surprised. Like I say, is he for the tariff? Is he against it? Who knows? Yeah, your guess is as good as mine.
Yeah, not even willing, Sherlin, to defend his own policy here particularly. Because this is his government's policy. They're totally behind it. Mm-hmm. He even says that he sees the need for it, but he can't go out and defend it properly.
Yeah, no, for sure. As Marius has mentioned, I think Ramaphosa has this tendency, you know, he arrives at the crime scene and is baffled by what has occurred. He's always surprised and shocked, as if though he was not in this government for how many years since Jacob Zuma's tenure. And I mean, even Ramaphosa, he was placed as when he was deputy president, Ramaphosa was given this war room, you know, that they proudly so boldly stated and bragged about.
We're what, 8 years into the Ramaphosa recovery of Eskom when he had the turnaround, he was in charge of the turnaround, right?
Sure. And I mean, he had an entire war room to solve this Eskom's challenges, and yet he's shocked by what is occurring right now. And yeah, even in the article, he makes this statement that, you know what, Eskom is, it's too big to fail. And I see, and I think that's exactly the problem. It is too big and it is already failing. I don't know, somebody really needs to wake up and oppose it to what's actually occurring. And especially this whole speak, or this PR stunt, whatever you like to call it, is where he's trying to relate to the common individual experiencing load shedding. Yet we know that his ministers, these high officials in government, they do not even pay for the electricity. They are completely withdrawn from anything that we experience, such as load shedding. So for him to try and relate to South Africans' struggle, it's just not working, in my opinion, Nick.
Yeah, no, it's poor. But anyway, okay.
Just to say, tell an old joke. Yeah, Cyril can't be shocked because there's no electricity in the country.
It reminds me of the one of the very first load shedding jokes from very early in when load shedding began, which is what did we have before candles?
Yeah, electricity.
Electricity. Anyway, speaking of load shedding, let's very quickly breeze over our last story. Joburg and Tshwane have seen the rise of usually homeless people directing traffic as unofficial pointsmen. And now the Johannesburg Metro Police and to some degree the Tshwane Metro Police have decided they're going to crack down on these people, saying that there's no liability for the city when they direct traffic. These guys aren't trained and they are a danger to public participation. What was interesting though was I think Times Live had a poll about whether people thought that homeless people directing traffic was a good or a bad thing. And a majority, I think it was 52% or something, said that it was a good thing. And some said it would be a good thing if they were trained, which is what Tshwane says that they plan to do. Very briefly, Marius, this is a symptom of kind of state collapse.
Yeah, exactly. I mean,
people, what do you think?
Ordinary people filling the gap where the state's left. But also, I mean, good for these homeless people, but they shouldn't be doing this job. I mean, number one, there should be working traffic lights. Number two, when there isn't, there should be you know, traffic police doing this kind of thing? And also, why should the China shouldn't be training homeless people? Their police officers should be there manning the traffic lights to make sure the traffic's working. And failing that, the traffic lights should be working. So it's all, yeah, it's, I mean, it's typical South Africa.
Sheldon, anything to add just to finish?
Yeah, no, Nick, I just think that the argument is being missed by them regarding why homeless people are there in the first place. I think it's abnormal for us to not have electricity in the first place. I think it's become so normalized that we are looking for solutions, you know, to merely subdue it and not to fix it. I think this is merely a symptom of the underlying problem, and I would much more encourage the government, the municipality, to focus on actually providing electricity, and you would not have this problem in the first place, Nick.
Indeed. All right. With that, let's close up for today. Thank you very much for listening. Please like the show, subscribe to us if you haven't already, and please rate us highly on the podcast apps, and we'll see you tomorrow on the Daily Print Show. Cheers, everyone.